Okay, our next speaker is Casey Harris. She's a PhD candidate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her area of specialization include modern France, Soviet history, and gender and women's studies. She's working on a dissertation about Franco-Soviet dance exchanges during the Cold War. Her dissertation explores how these dance exchanges provoked new debates about the relationship between consumer culture, gender, aesthetics, and ideology during the Cold War. From 2016 to 2017, she was a Fulbright Fellow in France, which allowed her to conduct research for this project. Okay.
I think. So for the dongle for this one. Oh, sorry. Okay. So I think the. Would you mind? I have it on a flash drive, but sorry about that. All right. Oops. Ooh. Okay. Hello. All right. I will get started then. Okay. The first Franco-Soviet ballet exchange in 1958 was a diplomatic success by all accounts, and this event ushered in a steady flow of dancers who traversed the Iron Curtain in the decades after Stalin's death in 1953. French diplomats, impresarios, and opera administrators eagerly coordinated dance exchanges with the Soviet Union, which promised both profit and prestige. So, just, I wanted to put this out as a reminder that this is also an artistic and dance exchange, even though this isn't really what I'm talking about in this paper, which is focused more on tourism. But as we see here, we have both French and Russian and even an English dancer choreographing a piece together and rehearsing together. So this was a chance for them to exchange choreography and talk about all of the aesthetic differences between French and Soviet and even English ballet. So here they are in the rotunda of the Paris Opera. All right. So French audience members and journalists extolled the arrival of Soviet dancers. And Bolshoi ballet performances sold out, often weeks before the company's arrival, in spite of augmented ticket prices. This is not to say that Franco-Soviet dance exchanges lacked controversy, but the tours were broadly received as a step in the right direction toward easing Cold War tensions. These cultural encounters were a tool for enhancing diplomatic relations between France and the Soviet Union, but they also enabled other points of contact that French and Soviet governments found more difficult to control. Dancers and theater employees on tour interacted with and formed relationships with people in their host country. They explored the host city's landscape, shopped for souvenirs, and tasted the host country's cuisine. Encounters that offered a rare opportunity for French and Soviet citizens to glimpse lives and cities that had been unattainable for decades. Through these early cultural exchanges, Cold War divisions were overcome in an unprecedented way. What did the concept of an Iron Curtain signify once its boundaries were no longer so ironclad? By examining Soviet artists' memoirs, French diplomatic reports, and opera archives from both countries, I trace how Soviet dancers prepared for the journey to France and discuss the economic, tourist, and social activities they engaged in while abroad. However, Soviet dancers came to Paris not only to see, but to be seen. French observers picked apart every aspect of Soviet companies' onstage performances, but they were equally interested in how their Soviet visitors behaved as tourists. Analyzing these close encounters during Franco-Soviet dance exchanges sheds light on how a wide variety of actors, from dancers to journalists to hotel clerks, participated in and made sense of Cold War politics. Through these interactions, participants realized that the Iron Curtain was more than a geographic and ideological barrier. It was a cultural construct that shaped interpretations of French and Soviet contact. French observers regarded their Soviet visitors through a lens of exoticism and eccentricity, characteristics nurtured by the Soviet population's, quote, willful isolation. Visiting artists' commercial activities were followed with great interest and deciphered in Cold War terms. For example, in the Parisian press, a Soviet ballerina's decision to purchase a French coat itself became a symbol of détente. Even as dance companies traversed the boundaries of the Soviet Union, confirmation bias, stereotypes, and propaganda solidified Cold War divisions as much as this new cultural contact defied them. Before Soviet dancers set foot on an airplane, they had to receive permission to travel abroad. Being a member of a touring dance company, even a famous soloist, did not imply automatic permission for international travel, which was reserved for Soviet citizens who could be relied upon to faithfully represent the Soviet Union to Western audiences. Once deemed politically reliable, Soviet dancers who toured abroad required some ideological and behavioral grooming. Before departing, all travelers attended a meeting where company administrators laid out strict rules of conduct. Dancers were forbidden from purchasing certain items while abroad. They were also instructed to never go out in small groups, no fewer than five people, and to never accept invitations to private homes. Several dancers recalled that, because of what they had been told about the West, they expected to be inundated with demands and tricks, encouraging them to betray their country. These pre-travel instructions served to keep Cold War divisions in place, even as the cultural exchange unfolded. As one French journalist remarked, although Soviet dancers had arrived in Paris, they brought along, quote, their very own portable Iron Curtain, unquote. Members of the company who disobeyed the prescribed rules would risk being sent home early, as happened to several Soviet dancers throughout the Cold War. The Soviet company's arrival was itself a production. Organized by French diplomatic officials, the welcoming of Soviet dancers provided opportunities for artists from both countries to meet and for journalists to capture this symbolic cultural rapprochement. During the 1958 Franco-Soviet dance exchange, Soviet dancers' first sight upon arrival in Paris was the airport tarmac, crowded with the press, bouquets of flowers, and French dancers waiting to greet the Soviet artists. The 150 Soviet dancers, theater administrators, and technical staff disembarked from the Tupolev aircraft, which departed several hours later to Moscow with 108 members of the Paris Opera Ballet Company on board. So, this is a horrible quality photo, I'm sorry, but it's from a newspaper. So this is the Paris Opera Ballet Company on Red Square in Moscow. It was the best photo I could find, but such as it is. So, and then here we have another, a French dancer, Madeleine Lafone, in front of MGU in Moscow. Unfortunately, it's cut off, but it's okay. You can get the idea, I guess. All right. Shortly after their arrival, Soviet artists were shuttled to a large reception organized by the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The ministry had set aside over 804,000 francs, nearly 14,500 today, for the event, and invited 600 people, including opera staff, representatives from both Soviet and French embassies, and about 150 ballet dancers. This was only the first of many receptions held throughout the Soviet company's tour in Paris, with the goal of, quote, putting foreign artists in contact with other artists and theater specialists. At these events, French and Soviet dancers socialized and formed friendships that were rekindled during future exchanges. So here's the Bolshoi Company as it arrived. There are so many flowers. In some photos, you can hardly see the dancers. There are so many flowers. And then here they are again, here at a reception. I'm sorry, it's cut off again. And then on the right, we have, I like how they're mixed together. So we have a Soviet dancer followed by a French dancer, Soviet dancer, the Soviet ambassador, and then a French dancer holding her little dog. So I like to see them bonding over the pet dog. All right. Bolshoi dancers spent about 3 weeks in Paris during the 1958 exchange, but most days were booked with rehearsals and performances. In spite of this rigorous performance schedule, the troupe experienced a whirlwind of tourist activities, which were organized and financed by the Paris Opera. French administrators carefully curated the Soviet dancers' visit, choosing sites and tours that highlighted France's highest cultural achievements in painting, architecture, sculpture, and theater. The dancers' visit was not that of an ordinary tourist. The artists' privileged position as cultural ambassadors opened up access to private tours, face-to-face meetings with famous French artists, choreographers, politicians, as well as extravagant dinners on the Eiffel Tower or at Maxim's. So here's dancer Galina Ulanova dancing with the secretary of the Paris Opera at Maxim's. So during their stay in Paris, the company visited the Eiffel Tower, Notre Dame Cathedral, the Rodin Museum, and the Louvre. They strolled through the Île Saint-Louis, and they spent an evening in the Bois de Boulogne. They spent an entire day exploring Versailles and Marie Antoinette's Hamlet, and concluded the evening with dinner on the Seine aboard a bateau-mouche riverboat. Much to the amusement of French observers, the members of the company took out little notebooks, taking note of everything they saw. The dancers also asked many detailed questions, such as, what kind of wood is this floor made of? French journalists noticed that the dancers kept their cameras ready and seemed to photograph every little thing, even the French landscape as seen from the buses. The patronizing tone of these observations in the Parisian press highlighted to readers that while the artists were among the Soviet Union's most respected cultural representatives, they were easily amazed by even the most basic qualities of French society. During the evenings, the French opera booked the Soviet visitors for performances that were uncontroversial, such as the Opéra Comique's rendition of an 18th century Italian opera, or a ballet at the Comédie Française. One exception to this was the Folies Bergères, to which the opera offered tickets on three different evenings during the Soviet tour. In flashy and erotic Folies Bergères acts, women danced in bedazzled leotards with plumes of feathers in their headpieces, a sight that Communist Party standards would declare a symbol of capitalist decadence. Opera officials likely did not intend to provoke controversy by prominently featuring the Folies on the Bolshoi's itinerary, but dancer Maya Plisetskaya recalled her embarrassment when she was approached by and photographed with two Folies Bergères dancers while her Soviet interpreter grumbled about the scandalous circumstances. So here she is with the dancers. Like an evening at the Folies Bergères, Soviet dancers' first exposure to Paris was overwhelming. We must use caution when drawing information from the memoirs of Soviet dancers who later defected. But several Soviet artists' accounts suggest that the sight of French shops and busy streets incited intense culture shock. The French press and some Soviet dancers asserted that this encounter with Paris brought on a destabilizing explosion of consumer desire in more vulnerable visitors. Several Soviet artists remembered walking down Parisian streets, struck by the variety of colors and sounds. In comparison to Paris, they suggested, Moscow and Leningrad seemed dreary and homogeneous. Ballerina Natalia Makarova recalled feeling like Alice in Wonderland, observing that, quote, Western life seemed more intense, opulent, and diverse than Soviet realities. When Kirov dancer Rudolf Nureyev illicitly explored Paris with several French dancers, he noticed that, quote, the people on the streets looked so interesting and so different from our drab Russian crowds. Partly because they had, quote, a hint of decadence and a lack of solid purpose. Dancers also mentioned being scandalized by the sight of couples kissing in the middle of the street. It was not unusual for Soviet company members to report feeling nauseous, overstimulated, and exhausted during their first tour in the West. After the sight of so much prosperity, Kirov artist Valery Panov reasoned, quote, their nervous systems needed time to adjust. Shaped by gender biases that assumed women had less self-control and more naturally consumeristic tendencies, both the French press and some Soviet memoirs suggest that the sight of French abundance contributed to psychological breakdowns and kleptomania. A pianist for the Kirov Ballet received her daily stipend and was later discovered staring through the window of an appliance store, mumbling to herself incoherently and immobilized by the decision about what to buy in the face of such variety. She was escorted back to the Soviet Union and lost her job. Bolshoi ballerina Olga Lepyshinskaya was arrested for stealing gloves, an umbrella, and buttons from a shop in Brussels just after leaving Paris on the 1958 tour, an incident which the French press covered with relish. So we have an article here about that. In the end, she was released, and it was okay. She was able to go back home. Okay. Stories like these fed French narratives of cultural and economic superiority and became a weapon in the French media. Color, noise, and variety represented choice, spontaneity, and excitement, a clear antithesis to gray, monotonous, communist cities. And I thought this was funny because this dancer, Galina Ulanova, was clearly so tired of being photographed that she refused to be photographed by covering herself, and multiple newspapers shared this photo and were very amused by the fact that she was so tired of them following her. Seizing the opportunity to highlight French prosperity in clear contrast to Soviet consumer culture, the Parisian press made a game out of following Soviet dancers into boutiques, department stores, and beyond. An interviewed hotel clerk from their Parisian hotel reported that the Soviet company was very quiet and polite, nothing like the, quote, circus that accompanied American tourists. In the evening, the clerk explained, the dancers kept to themselves by watching television and dined on canned preserves brought from Russia rather than going out to restaurants. Several Soviet artists explained that, to save money for shopping, nearly the whole company brought suitcases packed with Russian food, sardines, dehydrated soup, and other canned goods. Elena Chernichova, a dancer, recalled that after each performance, dancers retreated to the hotel and started cooking in their rooms. The dancers organized a schedule and took turns cooking to prevent straining the hotel's electricity supply. But occasionally, the fuses would short-circuit and the dancers flooded into the halls, grumbling that they would have to rework the whole cooking schedule. Avoiding restaurants likely had as much to do with maintaining a dancer's strict diet as saving money. But many French journalists were perplexed by the Soviet artists' canned preserves and interpreted this as a way for the company to isolate itself. According to one French journalist, shopping was the only area where he saw, quote, clear signs of détente in the Bolshoi company's behavior. So here are a couple of photos of Soviet dancers shopping. He admired the sight of ballerinas, quote, venturing into shops and coming out with their arms loaded with packages. Soviet ballerinas expressed admiration for French fashion, particularly that of Coco Chanel. French observers took this admiration for granted, offering disparaging descriptions of Soviet ballerinas' garments and concluding that Soviet attire could not compare with French fashion. After an interview with Bolshoi dancer Raisa Struchkova, one journalist reflected on the dancer's royal blue suit with a straight-cut jacket and skirt. Quote, it was not fashionable. It was without fashion. Unquote. While accompanying the Soviet troupe for several days, she saw a group of Bolshoi ballerinas poring over a copy of Elle that they had purchased, exclaiming and pointing at the models with every turn of the page. These, quote, signs of détente, as the above-mentioned journalists called them, primarily served the role of confirming French cultural superiority in the eyes of Parisians. And here's the Bolshoi company. They visited the Chanel fashion house in 1972. Of course, this was covered in the press as well. They got to try on dresses and even order some to take back with them. The French media's interest in Soviet ballerinas' enthralling encounters with Parisian fashion reflected one way that fashion became a Cold War battleground. In both the West and the East, consumerism was associated with women and femininity. Fueled by the expectation that Russian women would want to resemble French women, French journalists suggested that French civilization and culture offered an alternative to a stereotyped image of the drab, dowdy Soviet woman. This perspective merged normative gender roles and Cold War rhetoric to imply that true femininity could only be found in France, where the government did not exercise so much control over the fashion industry. Soviet dancers on tour enjoyed greater access to foreign commodities than ever before, but they were no strangers to products from abroad. Contraband clothing items smuggled into the Soviet Union fetched a large price, and many people were happy to pay for the quality and distinction offered by French or American clothing. Dancer Maya Plisetskaya noted that Bolshoi ballet dancers relied on such items to dress themselves with dignity. As she explained, quote, "After all, you can't find a good-looking dress in GUM, the large department store in Moscow. In my whole life, I didn't see a single one in GUM," unquote. Plisetskaya recalls the judgmental gaze produced on Moscow streets by her provocative foreign couture. After Plisetskaya's 1966 trip to Paris, a woman saw her sporting a French Astrakhan coat and crossed herself, explaining, quote, "Oh Lord, isn't she a sinner?" Unquote. Luxurious clothing was a mark of excess that called into question one's socialist credentials. Makeup was viewed with the same degree of skepticism. During the Khrushchev era, Soviet fashion aesthetics no longer renounced distinctions between men and women, but still required that women dress themselves rationally by avoiding tacky, indulgent clothing found in Western countries. Instead, Soviet women's magazines showcased practical, tasteful attire, insisting that simple meant fashionable. Soviet ballerinas were cultural ambassadors to the West, but as celebrities, they were also models for proper comportment within the Soviet Union. Some dancers, like Plisetskaya, chafed at the limits of good taste in the Soviet Union by donning French couture, which was an especially controversial message when displayed on the body of a Bolshoi ballerina. So, what did the Soviet artists bring home from their sojourn in France? Most likely, they passed souvenirs to family members and friends and remembered their French experiences when they wore the coat they bought in a Parisian boutique, even if perhaps their new purchase attracted glares. Their visit lingered in the French press and in discussions about the state of French ballet in the world, and their very presence in Paris suggested to French observers that the world had changed. At a time when the Soviet Union increasingly allowed citizens to travel abroad and sought to fulfill and control consumer desire, Soviet ballerinas' Parisian shopping sprees and tourist excursions offer a way to explore tensions between this shift in Soviet policy and its consequences. Touring artists towed the line between representing the Soviet Union and engaging with capitalism in new ways, a performance that unfolded before the eager eyes of French journalists, artists, and others. But even if many French observers interpreted the Soviet tour as an indication that Soviet artists had, quote, outwitted the Iron Curtain, French journalists and audience members kept the Soviet visitors at arm's length, even mobilizing the Soviet dancers' actions and appearance to validate French cultural and political authority. Although dancers had physically traversed east-west barriers during this early dance exchange, the conceptual Iron Curtain may in fact have been consolidated. Ooh, okay, that's the end before I drop my page.